Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Sue Monk Kidd drew on the life of abolitionist Sarah Grimke for her new novel, The Invention of Wings. Grimke and her sister Angelina were outspoken activists in the early 19th century and were authors, with Angelina's husband, of American Slavery as It Is, Testimony of a Thousand Witnesses about the Horrors of Slavery in the United States. Kidd's book is about the relationship between Sarah and a slave named Hetty Handful Grimke, who becomes Sarah's property when they're both young girls. The story follows their lives over the next 35 years. Sue Monk Kidd grew up in Georgia before and during the Civil Rights Movement, which has had a strong influence on her writing and on her life. She's the author of several other novels, including The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid Chair. And Sue Monk Kidd, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book.
There was a time in Africa the people could fly. Mama told me this one night when I was 10 years old. She said, "Handful, your granny mama saw it for herself. She say they flew over trees and clouds. She say they flew like blackbirds. When we came here, we left that magic behind." My mama was shrewd. She didn't get any reading and writing like me. Everything she knew came from living on the scarce side of mercy. She looked at my face, how it flowed with sorrow and doubt, and she said, "You don't believe me? Where you think these shoulder blades of yours come from, girl?" Those skinny bones stuck out from my back like nubs. She patted them and said, "This all what left of your wings. They nothing but these flat bones now. But one day, you gon' get 'em back." I was shrewd like Mama. Even at 10, I knew this story about people flying was pure malarkey. We weren't some special people who lost our magic. We were slave people, and we weren't going anywhere. It was later I saw what she meant. We could fly all right, but it wasn't any magic to it. The day my life turned into nothing this world could fix, I was in the workyard, boiling slave bedding, stoking fire under the washpot, my eyes burning from specks of lye soap catching on the wind. The morning was a cold one. The sun looked like a little white button stitched tight to the sky. For summers, we wore homespun cotton dresses over our drawers, but when the Charleston winter showed up like some lazy girl in November or January, we got into our sacks, these thick-set coats made of heavy yarns, just an old sack with sleeves. Mine was a cast-off and trailed to my ankles. I couldn't say how many unwashed bodies had worn it before me, but they had all kindly left their scents on it. Already that morning, Mrs. had taken her cane stick to me once across my backside for falling asleep during her devotions. Every day, all us slaves, everyone but Rosetta, who was old and demented, jammed in the dining room before breakfast to fight off sleep, while Mrs. taught us short Bible verses like "Jesus wept," and prayed out loud about God's favorite subject, obedience. If you nodded off, you got whacked right in the middle of "God said this" and "God said that."
And that's Sue Monk Kidd reading from the very beginning of her new novel. It's called The Invention of Wings, and it's told in alternating chapters. That was a chapter, Hetty Handful Grimke talking about her life living in Charleston. There's are all other chapters where Sarah Grimke talks about her life. And I have to say, Hetty Handful Grimke has a strong voice and a strong personality. Did she come to you fully formed?
Well, I don't think any character starts off fully formed, and they grow as you write them and get to know them. And but I probably was surprised at how much she had to say to me in my head, how much she wanted to talk. Her voice came a little more readily and was more accessible to me than Sarah's voice, which may have been one of the surprises I had in writing the book.
Because Hetty's black and a slave, that somehow she felt more real to you?
Well, she would be more distant, probably, from my perspective of growing up as a white woman in the South. But at the same time, I felt this compelling need to write her story. It was a very strong thing with me. And I feel that as writers, we shouldn't limit any voice or story or possibility or voice. You know, we need to think about inclusion and let these characters come alive in us empathetically as we possibly can. So I kind of took a deep breath and did it. But, you know, I should say that I felt at the time the main reason that her voice was a little more accessible to me was because she didn't come with a big historical script like Sarah did. I mean, she had free rein of my imagination, and she could pretty much say and do what she wanted.
And there's a piece of fact in this relationship, in that Sarah Grimke, as a young girl, was given a slave.
Yes, that's true. It's a little footnote in Sarah's life. When she was probably around 11 to 12, she was given what they called euphemistically a waiting maid. Mm-hmm. It was an enslaved girl in the household, and her name was Hetty. And we know that Sarah taught her to read, which was against the law in South Carolina. And other than that, we really don't know anything. Well, they were caught and punished, we know that, but we don't know how. And then Hetty, unfortunately, died young, probably in her adolescence. But that's all we knew. But when I saw that, I thought, here's the other half of the story.
Sarah Grimke was a real person. She and her sister grew up in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina, where you live for some time now, and did become an ardent abolitionist and did write this book, American Slavery as It Is. I'm assuming you have read this book.
Yes. They wrote this book later in life. In fact, they wrote it after the story in my novel ends. They had a long life after the story ends, but it was one of the first things that they did after they had their public crusade, which was quite exciting in American life when they hit the road. And this Slavery as It Is was their first-person testimony or accounts of what they witnessed growing up in the South. And it's quite clear, honest, and brutal.
And when it says testimony of 1,000 witnesses, can we assume some of those witnesses were slaves?
I think we can. Many of the accounts that Sarah wrote were her own observations, but they told many stories that they gathered from newspapers across the country. They did an exhaustive study and search for accounts from slaves and were able for the first time to really put that before the American public and say, here it is. And I understand from my research that this document, this book, had quite an influence on Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Oh, in her creation, her writing of Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Yes, that it had some impact on her.
This book is about what is urban slavery. This is the slavery that happened inside of cities. And Hetty is one of a number of slaves in the Grimke household. Help us understand what slavery was like when it was lived in a city.
Well, it looked differently than a lot of the stereotypical ideas we might have about slavery on the plantation, for instance. It operated differently. You would have in Charleston, for instance, a situation where the slave population was as large as the white population, and at times even a little larger. So at any given time, the streets of Charleston in the early 19th century would be teeming with enslaved people who would be out with badges or passes to work for hire. And there were networks of information, and it was controlled by a system of surveillance. So there were badges and passes and ordinances and curfews and all kinds of city guard to keep this system in place.
Sort of like apartheid.
Well, it was a police state. Yes, yeah. Apartheid. It was very similar to that.
And the idea, I mean, obviously had its own brutality, some of which you write about in the book as well.
Well, yes. In the Grimke family, of course, this is a story of fiction and history. So I was writing from a place where imagination and history intersect. But I do know from Sarah's earliest biography that Mrs. Grimke, her mother, visited what they call, this is how they put it, visited common punishments on her slaves. And those common punishments had to do with floggings in the yard. There was a work yard behind the main house in Charleston. There were so many opulent mansions on the harbor and on East Bay. And the Grimke house was one of those, a very wealthy slave-holding family at the top of the planter class. In the back of the house would be the enslaved population that served them. Mm. And they would live over the kitchen house or over the stables. And yes, they often, Sarah herself writes about witnessing a flogging in the yard. And this scene is in the very opening of her chapter.
Yeah, and in fact, it's also part of the story that you write about her witnessing a flogging.
That part is based on Sarah's diaries. She writes, and also in this Slavery as It Is, she writes about witnessing at around 4 years old and then running away from home and getting on board a ship in the harbor across the street from her house. And I tried to capture that scene and to show how dramatically that impacted her voice. I mean, this novel is, in a large way, it's about race and gender, slavery and women's rights and abolition. But at the same time, it's about the human need to find our voice and dare to speak it with truth and boldness in the world in the hopes of changing something. And this is where Sarah begins her journey to find her voice.
And you lived for a number of years in South Carolina, in Charleston, South Carolina. Did you know of the Grimke sisters?
No, and this was completely wrong that I didn't know about them.
And are there markers there?
The house where the Grimkes lived on East Bay Street is now an attorney's office, but it's very well preserved, and it has no marker on it. It's known as the Blake House, actually, in Charleston. And I had been driving by this house for 10 years, at least, without any realization of who had lived there, these two extraordinary women who turned out to be the first female abolition agents in America.
Had they been erased, or people just did not know?
Well, I think they are known in academic circles. And I think they were known by a lot of people in Charleston, certainly at the College of Charleston, and many people who were informed about that. I didn't grow up there, and maybe I would have learned about them in school. Right. I don't know. But I don't think they are as well known in the popular imagination and in history. They seem to have fallen through a crack. So if we said Elizabeth Cady Stanton, maybe we don't think of Sarah Grimke the same way.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. I do want to get another reading as well. And our guest is Sue Monk Kidd, and she has a new book that we have been talking about, The Invention of Wings. She wrote two previous novels, The Mermaid Chair and The Secret Life of Bees. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students are given individual attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed. A character development program founded on respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance is woven into day-to-day school life. Their next open house is Tuesday, January 28th at 9 a.m. More information at chapinschool.org.
Tomorrow night, an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech, an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY-TV, online at WHYY.org, and right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, 50 years after President Johnson declared the war on poverty, how are things going in the poorest state in the nation?
76% of Mississippi's poor children live with a single mom, and those are moms who are working.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Soo Mung Kid's first two novels, The Secret Life of Bees and The Mermaid Chair, were bestsellers. Her new novel, The Invention of Wings, has just been published. It's set in pre-Civil War Charleston, South Carolina, also in Philadelphia, about an unlikely relationship between a slave and an abolitionist. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We began with a reading of Hetty talking about her life. Let's hear how Sarah describes her life.
That morning was full of cold, bright wind pouring off the Atlantic and clouds blowing like windsocks. For a moment, I stood just inside the room, listening to the saber fronds on the palmettos clatter around the house. The eaves of the piazza hissed. The porch swing groaned on its chains. Downstairs, in the warming kitchen, Mother had the slaves pulling out Chinese tureens and Wedgwood cups, preparing for my birthday party. Her maid, Cindy, had spent hours wetting and fastening Mother's wig with paper and curlers, and the sour smell of it baking had nosed all the way up the stairs. I watched as Benna, the nursery mama, tucked my clothes into the heavy old wardrobe, recalling how she used a fire poke to rock Charles's cradle, her cowrie shell bracelets rattling along her arms while she terrified us with tales of the Booga Hag, an old woman who rode about on a broom and sucked the breath from bad children. I would miss Benna, and sweet Anna, who slept with her thumb in her mouth, Ben and Henry, who jumped like banshees until their mattresses erupted with geysers of goose feathers, and little Eliza, who had the habit of slipping into my bed to hide from the Booga's nightly reign of terror. Of course, I should have graduated from the nursery long ago, but I'd been forced to wait for John to go away to college. Our three-storied house was one of the grandest in Charleston, but it lacked enough bedrooms, considering how, well, fruitful Mother was. There were 10 of us, John, Thomas, Mary, Frederick, and myself, followed by the nursery dwellers, Anna, Eliza, Ben, Henry, and baby Charles. I was the middle one, the one Mother called different, and Father called remarkable, the one with the carroty hair and the freckles, whole constellations of them. My brothers had once traced Orion, the Dipper, and Ursa Major on my cheeks and forehead with charcoal, connecting the bright red specks, and I hadn't minded. I'd been their whole sky for hours.
And that's Soo Mung Kid, again, reading from her new novel, The Invention of Wings. And Sarah Grimke, in your novel, and my understanding is also in her real life, she wanted to be a lawyer.
She did. She had aspirations. She wanted a vocation. She came from a family of lawyers. Her father was a very prominent judge on the highest court of South Carolina. She had a brother who was a physician and two other brothers who were lawyers and judges. But she loved the law. But I think most of all, what she wanted was to have a voice in the world, to have her life matter. She was constantly asking, why am I here?
She is given, and this is true in the novel, true apparently in her life as well, she's given this young girl as a slave, as her property in your novel. She doesn't want her. I mean, she tries to protest and to say, I don't want to have a slave.
Yes, and I don't know from Sarah's diary whether she was that unwelcoming to have the slave or not. She doesn't say, but I felt, because of what she had witnessed at 4, she would not want this slave. And I tried to create a scene in which she tried to free this slave,
right,
and resist it. But of course, you know, this would not work at all.
Because she was a girl, I guess, and also a young girl as well. And whatever her parents decided, that was going to be.
Yes, apparently. And I think her mother talked about Sarah and her sister Angelina as being her alien daughters. She referred to them that way. They were the two that were different, and she didn't quite know what to do with them. And she was trying to get them in line with the traditions and the culture, and it worked not in an easy way, but and eventually not at all.
You know, I have to say, if there is a villain character in your novel, it's the mother. I mean, she's the one who instigates the whippings that we witness as we read this story. She's the one who criticizes Sarah, obviously criticizes Hetty's mother as well. Charlotte is sort of targeted by this mother as well. She's a sadistic person.
Yes, Sarah refers to her as mean, and that's in the novel. But I don't know in reality exactly how far she would go, but in a story, there has to be someone who becomes the antagonist. And so it was, you know, it was fairly easy to see her in that way because she was so strident in her ways, very set, very controlling, and I think not a soft-hearted woman at all.
Not at all.
No. And so, you know, she inflicts a lot of punishments there that I think were unfortunately typical.
In this novel, Sarah witnesses a slave being whipped at her mother's command and begins to stutter. I mean, in a sense, loses her voice and then only finds it to discover that she has this stutter. Was that also true in the real Sarah Grimke's life?
No, this was not true. But what it was based on something. Sarah Grimke, in reality, had a very hard time speaking in public. I mean, she was not known for her voice, or her sister Angelina was a wonderful orator, quite famous for it. But Sarah was shy. She had this halting way of speaking, and she mumbled. And there's a great amount of writing about how bad it was. So I took that and sort of extrapolated into it, as a novelist might, to serve her story. Gave
you can
her
do that,
a speech
right?
impediment. Well, yes. I mean, some say the whole point of being a novelist is to take a bad situation and make it worse. So that's what I did here.
I don't know how to describe the relationship between Sarah and Hetty because it's so unequal. I don't know if they're friends in your mind or whether they are companions of some sort. How do you see their relationship? And this is the relationship between even an abolitionist, you know, a white abolitionist and a slave who operate in very different spheres.
I see it as all of those things you said. It was disfigured kind of relationship by the guilt that Sarah felt, by the defiance that Hetty Handful sometimes had. There were so many things going on here. Yes, a huge, vast divide between them. There was nothing egalitarian about this relationship. And yet, they related. And that was how it was at the time. There were these relationships, and they were sometimes had some authentic, genuine threads in them, and sometimes, mostly, they did not. Mm. But I wanted to portray between a privileged, white, abolitionist-hearted woman and an enslaved woman, this attempt to cross the divide, to find a way to relate. And it was a very uneasy kind of relationship. Sometimes it was friendship, sometimes it wasn't.
Yeah. There's a scene where Sarah says to Hetty, you know, I know, in a sense, I know how you feel. And Hetty says back to her, basically, no, you don't.
Yes, that's putting it mildly, what Hetty said.
I couldn't say it on the air, what she said, but, yeah. But kind of put her in her place
exactly.
In a way.
And this was a comeuppance for Sarah as an adolescent to realize this. And she didn't understand it because her world was shrunk to and very limited to what a woman could do, too. It had its own form of slavery about it. It didn't compare by any stretch to what Hetty Handful experience.
Right.
But Sarah thought, because she was female and she was denied so much, she had no rights. And her mother and her grandmother, I mean, there were no rights here at all, sometimes even to their own children. And they were confined pretty much to the domestic sphere. And so she thought she could relate to Handful's experience, but Handful put her straight pretty quickly.
Yes, she did. And that's Sue Monk Kidd, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about her new novel called The Invention of Wings. And again, she's the author of The Secret Life of Bees, The Mermaid Chair. She's also written some books about her life and her spiritual journeys. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I was telling you before we went on the air that you do have in this book some very graphic and vivid descriptions of beatings. And one of the person that is terribly beaten is Hetty's mother, Charlotte. It's hard to read. I saw 12 Years a Slave. It's hard to watch that, although I think it's important to both read and to watch that to help us understand the kind of brutality and sadism of one person, and in the case of your book, slaves being ordered to whip another slave.
Well, when I was researching the novel, I came across hair-raising kinds of narratives about what happened during this time. I think there has been, a kind of whitewashing myth about a lot of this, as in they were well, you know, enslaved people were well taken care of, they were part of the family, they were happy. I mean, you have heard this travesty talked about, I think, at times. And I was determined that in this novel, I would try to render it as honestly and as clearly as I could. And after reading these narratives, I mean, I felt like I was being temperate, to be honest with you.
Really?
Oh, yes. I mean, some of it was almost too much, I thought, to even to write for my reader to take in, that it would be an overload of that kind of harsh, brutal experience to take in. So I felt like I was being somewhat judicious, believe it or not. But it is so important, I think, to be willing as Americans to look at this and begin to resolve this part of our American history. I don't think it's resolved yet. It still seems to be the great American wound buried in our history. And it needs to be resolved. And the only way, really, to do that is to bring it out, talk about it, and come to terms with this.
How do you think novels, though? I mean, this is a kind of historical novel or a fictional story that draws from history. How do you think novels can do that?
Well, perhaps start a conversation. I do think that's important, but also it gives the reader an opportunity to enter the lives of an enslaved person or even a white woman at the time who had no right to vote or have a profession or have, you know, who was limited. It gives us a way through our mind and our heart really to drop into their lives and experience the world as they did, to really feel it. And that's what I most wanted, I guess, was to have a felt experience of the story.
Empathy.
Empathy, absolutely. This may be the real power of fiction. And I certainly think it is, that we have this mysterious ability as humans to experience in our souls what might happen with another person. It's one of the most beautiful things that we can experience, actually. And I think it's a saving experience. And that potential and power is in a novel to do.
Hetty's mother, Charlotte, is a very gifted seamstress, makes beautiful quilts. Were there certain, and there have been some very famous quilt makers whose work have been presented at museums and things. Was there a certain quilter that you were thinking of when you created this part of Charlotte's life?
Yes, indeed. I came across the slave quilts, they're called, by Harriet Powers, and her work is in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and in the Smithsonian, and I made this little pilgrimage to Washington to see one of them, and I just thought it was a masterpiece of narrative and art. She was telling a story through this quilt, and I thought, aha, you know, women who were illiterate, who were forbidden to read and write, how do they convey their story other than oral tradition? They want some way to tell their story. So I gave this story quilt to Handful's mother.
Yeah. You also include a character, real person named Denmark Vesey, mm-hmm. who was a freed slave in Charleston at the time.
Yes, one of the
which
more...
Which is sort of unusual to think of that.
There was a fairly large free black population in Charleston. Denmark Vesey is one of the most fascinating characters in American history and also not well known enough. He hatched the largest slave plot idea in American history, and it was foiled in Charleston. If that insurrection had actually been successful, we would all be easily saying his name and know who he was. But I entwined his life, this slave plot he concocted with Handful and her mother and their lives, and sort of embroiled them in this time.
But also to tell us that there, I mean, we should know this by now, but that there were not only slave revolts, but there were big and small ways that slaves were getting revenge for the system that enslaved them.
Exactly. And that was motivating for me to want to include Denmark Vesey in this story, not only because it brought an enormous amount of intrigue and drama into the story, but because it gave me a way to acknowledge that enslaved people and free black people were struggling and resisting. They were dying. They were fighting. They were subverting the system, sometimes in small ways, sometimes in large ways. But this was happening too, and I don't think we quite know the extent of that.
Hetty's punished for knowing how to read. I mean, she's punished several times in the novel when it's sort of discovered that she's reading things that Sarah has either given to her or written herself.
Yes,
can you imagine? A high price to pay.
Yes, for reading. And Sarah dared to teach her. So this is an important way for enslaved people to learn, and when that happens, they have access to information that could be dangerous, as it was seen. So this is why they were forbidden to read and write.
We have another break in about a minute here, but some of the story takes place in Philadelphia, and in real life, Sarah and her sister, I guess, and her sister's husband, or they end up in Philadelphia.
They do. Sarah comes to Philadelphia by a really interesting coincidence is how she ended up here. She comes to Philadelphia first with her father, who is ill, and there was a very famous surgeon here, one of the most famous in America, Dr. Physick. And Sarah's father was sent up here to see him, and Sarah's to accompany him on this journey. She didn't want to do it. She didn't want to leave Angelina, but she is ordered to do this by her mother. So she comes, and it changes her world, as we might say, it rocks her world. And she learns for the first time, I can negotiate the world as a woman on my own, taking care of my father, not the other way around. She saw to the money bags and the accounts and the transportation and everything. This was, I think, an eye-opening moment for her, but she has to go home. She falls into a deep depression when she goes home and realizes her world now has closed up again.
And that's Sue Monk Kidd, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book, her third novel called The Invention of Wings. Much more after this short break. We do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Questions or comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
Open Connections, a progressive educational environment, supports WHYY. At Open Connections, youth ages 2 through 18 attend programs 1 to 3 days a week from September to June. Guided by their principles of respect, freedom, responsibility, and natural learning, Open Connections serves as a community base for young people and their families seeking an innovative, collaborative, and process-conscious educational environment. An open house at their campus in Newtown Square is Sunday, February 9th at 4 p.m. Details at openconnections.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the troubling alliance between the Catholic Church and Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Historian David Kurtzer says while many believe the Church heroically opposed fascism, newly released material documents the critical support and moral authority the Church lent the regime in the 20s and 30s. His book is called The Pope and Mussolini. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again at 7 on WHYY.
Well-known neuropsychiatrist and author Dan Siegel has written Brainstorm, Understanding the Teenage Brain. Now, I can hear every parent out there smirking, good luck with that. Nevertheless, best-selling author of Mindsight has written a very readable book helping us all understand what does and doesn't happen in those brains. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Dr. Dan Siegel. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Sue Monk-Kidd about writing and a little bit about her life, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You grew up in Sylvester, Georgia. Describe the Sylvester, I guess, of your childhood.
Well, Sylvester, at the time I was a child, there was 3,500 people. So we were a small town in the South. Pre-civil rights America, pre-feminist America. You know, in many ways, it was very Mayberry-esque, but, you know, there was a whole other side of that, too, great racial divides. And I grew up against a backdrop of civil rights marches and Rosa Parks. And, you know, that time, it imprinted on me race and that struggle. Mm. Made a huge difference in my life.
Was it a segregated town, I guess by law, but also just by the way it looked? People lived in separate worlds?
Yes, indeed. It was very divided, the white population from the black population, segregation. I remember my grandfather actually was a judge in this little town. He was the city court judge, and I remember going to the courthouse and the separate water fountains with the signs above them, you know, uh-huh. colored white. So this was the world of American South at the time.
Did your parents talk about it? Was it an issue in the family?
My parents were, it wasn't an issue we talked about it a great deal, but my parents and my family were certainly supportive of civil rights. But it wasn't a big issue. It was a quiet issue at the time there because it was quite dangerous not to be quiet about that. So this is part of my life and struggle, was to find the voice, find my voice, let us find our voice, and have the courage to speak it.
Dangerous because if you spoke out, you had to worry about the KKK, for instance? Were they a presence in your town or in that part of Georgia?
I only saw them once. I don't think the fear was about that so much. I think the fear was something I put in Sarah's mouth in the novel, which was ostracism. She says, I feared the ostracism worst of all. But I think the KKK was certainly a presence in the South. And I remember one instance where they marched into our town in full garb.
Wow.
And how very terrifying it was. I must have been, maybe 10-ish, and downtown and seeing that and running for cover, not knowing what it meant. So these kinds of experiences are in my memory, and naturally, as a writer, you know, I've wanted to explore that.
Yeah. Did your family have black domestics? Did they... people that cleaned the house or cooked or took care of the yard?
Yes, we had black domestics in my family, and that was incredibly common. And it was an uneasy thing to come to terms with later. You know, I wrote, one of the first essays I wrote was about this, and I was told by everyone, don't write about that.
Oh.
And I thought, but this is my history. This is my past. I'm not okay with it. But what do I do with it? So I needed to explore all of that to come to terms and make my own understanding.
Mm-hmm. And how much of your evolution, if I can say that, about, let's say, civil rights and some of the history of this country, and also your faith? Because it also seems like you have gone on a journey of discovery about spirituality and faith, what you truly believed in.
Well, spirituality has been a large part of my life. I think in many ways I see life and the world through a certain spiritual lens. I think, I mean, it's broadened out over time. I mean, I tend to think that spirituality is this process of evolution of our consciousness so that we become more and more conscious about life and enables us to relate more deeply. To me, spirituality is also about compassion and empathy and learning how to enlarge the heart and to enlarge our consciousness. It's mostly about that. So I've tried, you know, that's been my journey for a very long time.
I was reading that you grew up in a Christian family. Was it a conservative Christian family?
No, I would say it was kind of midstream,
middle of the road Christian.
Middle of the road Protestantism in the South. In that little town where I grew up, there was a Methodist church and a Baptist church, and that was it. Oh. The Presbyterians tried to make a presence, but they went belly up. So we were really just a two-church town. And so you belong to one or the other. Right. And, you know, at the time, it was before a great deal of this fundamentalism and conservatism.
Yeah. Is there a name for what you believe today?
I would say that, you know, I have a very spiritual feeling about my life, and I have a faith, although it's not sectarian now. So I don't attend church, for instance.
Need a name, though?
No, I don't think it does. It is just what is. I don't tend to think of it being the spiritual life or the creative life or the home life. I mean, for me, it's all become one thing, and it's living true to oneself with a compassionate heart and with as much consciousness as you can find. That's the spiritual life. But so much of it for me is about writing. I mean, that's how I pray, is to write the deepest thing in me.
Because you're going, what, deep inside?
I'm trying.
Exploring your own. Yes, I understand. I know I made it sound very, very easy, and I know that's not true. But did you have a, you know, quote-unquote crisis of faith? Was there a period in your life where you just felt like this wasn't speaking to you, the person that you were?
Of course, I did. And I wrote about that in one of my books, initially in When the Heart Waits, was a story of my own crisis of faith and encounter with certain things I needed to leave behind and move on, and this kind of opening up of my world. So I tried to capture it. I became very contemplative at the time, and I still, you know, have that contemplative bent in me. And then I had another kind of moment where it was a collision of feminism and religion in my life, where I had to grapple with that. And I wrote another book about that, which is The Dance of the Dissident Daughter, which is what I guess writers do sometimes. I have a memoirist in me as well as a novelist.
So are you known as the dissident daughter in your family?
Oh, very much so.
Proudly, or have they embraced the dissident daughter?
Yes, my mother refers to her, she's 92 now, she refers to herself as a dissident daughter, too.
Oh.
So, you know, I say, well, my mission in life is accomplished if you've become one, too.
It helps to be a bestseller, though, doesn't it, if you want to be a dissident daughter?
It does, yeah, I guess so.
You studied nursing, though, early on, is that right?
I did.
You thought you would be a nurse, or perhaps you worked as a nurse?
Well, I did work in my 20s as a registered nurse.
Oh, wow.
I wanted to be a writer. This was my first failure of courage, I guess, when it became time to go to college in 1966. I just couldn't seize the moment. I had no role models or no real cultural support for this idea of, oh, I'm going to go be a writer. I didn't quite know how to make that happen. We were still saying things at that time like, you've got to have a profession to fall back on in case, you know, you don't get married or some such as that.
I heard that.
Oh, yeah. We've all maybe at a certain generation heard that. But so I went and studied nursing, and I chose it because it's such a noble, wonderful profession, but it wasn't my place of belonging. And I had to find my way back to writing, which I did when I was 30 years old.
Are you surprised? And then I'll get to some callers, but the Secret Life of Bees was such a popular book, made into a play, made into a movie. I mean, this was your first novel. You'd written some other books as well, but that it found such a huge audience?
Well, of course, I was astonished by all of that. At the time I was writing the novel, I don't think any first novelist imagines their book will have that many readers. Never did it enter my mind. I was pretty much thinking I wanted a respectable, you know, audience. I wanted my family to like it. I wanted my friends to like it. But no, that was a great surprise of my life. Yeah.
And I mean, I always wonder, and as I said, you were, it's not like you were 19 years old. I mean, you were a mature adult. But at the same time, to write a book that is so popular like that, whether that sets such a high bar for the next novel to come, or in this case, the third novel to come, whether that haunts you in any way.
Well, I confess it did haunt me when I started the second novel. I got so many people wanting a sequel to The Secret Life of Bees. So I was determined not to tamper with that one and just leave that world like it was. But I did feel daunted by the idea of writing another novel. Yeah. And I had to get over that. And I did get over it fairly quickly. I mean, I gave myself a month to be anxious about all of that. And then I said, all right, that's all. You have to just write your story and not worry about it.
Let me get, it looks like Rosemary from Jenkintown to join our conversation. Rosemary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, I just practically moved to tears. Oh, I just love you. I just think it's wonderful.
You.
We're going in the right direction. The greatest crime this country has ever suffered from is slavery. And you do it so beautifully with those Grimpe gals who are fantastic Quakers. I just love you guys, and I always love Marty.
Oh,
but I thank you, Miss Kidd, so much.
Well, and you're so welcome.
Movie made into them. I don't care what. I'm your fan full time.
There you go,
well,
Rosemary. Thank you.
Appreciate that so much.
Do you have certain ways of writing? I mean, certain habits of writing. Once you, I guess, are hunkering down to write a novel.
Yes,
you're rolling your eyes at me.
I'm rolling my eyes because I am so dogged about it. That I hate to tell you. When I'm working on a book, and I will take a time off after I finish a book to sort of let my mind be fallow and rest my brain a little bit. But when I'm working, I'm really working, and I work sometimes 10 hours a day at my desk and get lost in all of that world and have to be dragged out. But and sometimes it's every day until I realize I have to take a little time off and rest. I do walk on the beach or take a walk in the mornings, usually before I work, but then I dig in.
Wow. And do you have a harsh critic on your shoulder?
I have both. And I think that a harsh critic for a writer can be devastating if you listen to that and that's all you hear. But I think a gentle critic on your shoulder from time to time isn't a bad thing, really. I tell myself, and I tell other writers too when they ask, that it's good to both be confident about your work, to believe utterly in what you are doing, but at the same time doubt it, because that keeps that work really moving and alive and striving.
And does your family leave you alone when you're writing novels?
around the house? Or? They're very good about being supportive of me. I have been writing now since I was 30 years old, and the children were small, and you know, they were great about leaving Mama alone to write when I needed to. And my husband has always been incredibly supportive of me. And he not only gives me space and time, but he's a voice of, I think, confidence for me, too, in validating what I'm doing.
Is he a first reader for you as well?
My daughter is my first reader. We have a little tradition. I don't know how we fell into it, in which my husband reads the manuscript after I'm finished. And my daughter reads it chapter by chapter and gives me feedback. So it's a family affair here.
And does that mean there is a book waiting for you at some point in the near, distant, or far future then?
Well, I hope so. Right now, I'm just not ready to leave my characters in this novel. I'm not ready to leave The Invention of Wings.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be with it a while longer. And I'm one of those writers who the idea has to sort of organically come, and it seizes me, and then it you know, my imagination plays with it, and then I have a book suddenly. And that will come at a certain point, but I'll have to probably rest up a bit before that happens.
And how important is a title for you?
Really important.
The title of a novel or book that you write?
Very. And I don't know why that is. I don't think that's true for a lot of writers. But I love to have the title before I start. In fact, I feel kind of uneasy until I get that title. It focuses the whole story for me. It gives me these parameters and sometimes a metaphor, as in the case of The Invention of Wings. It gives me a metaphor to work with. And that's what my characters are doing here. They are inventing their wings.
And did this title come to you fully formed, or were you wrestling with it or walking on the beach saying, what am I going to call my third novel?
Something like that. I mean, I spent a whole day one time trying to come up with a title, and I must have written down 200 titles that were really not right. And then suddenly, The Invention of Wings popped in my head, fully formed like that. And really? I knew instantly that was it, and I wrote it down. And then I thought, okay, now I can really go to work because I know what the title is. So I think this is a strange idiosyncrasy. I don't recommend it.
Seems to be working. Well, Sue Monk Kidd, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. It's been a great pleasure.
It was my pleasure.
And her book, her third novel just published, called The Invention of Wings. Her first novel came out about 10 years ago called The Secret Life of Bees, and that was followed by a second novel, The Mermaid Chair. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Carry on a conversation on our homepage. You can also find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and check out the archives and the podcasts as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.